LDB, ba 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 LDB, ba 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 LDB, 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 LDB.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It's time for your favorite podcast. It's the LDB podcast, and we are here. I'm your host, Chris Schutzer, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-commissioner, Mr. Matthew Starr.
How you doing, Chris?
You know, the way I said that, that was very fumbly, and I'm not your co-commissioner, but I probably gave the listeners a hint here to who we're going to be joined by. You are a co-commissioner. The other co-commissioner, not Chris Schutzer, is Mr. Ian Amelkin, and he's also here. Ian, how you doing, buddy?
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be back on the podcast.
You know, usually I try to think about what I'm going to say before we started, but that was just like, you know, the equivalent of the butt fumble right there. Call me Mark Sanchez for the rest of the cast. We are not joined by Becker and Sean tonight. Unfortunately, I think they're both a little under the weather, hoping it's not COVID. And so, you know, I wish them speedy recoveries, but at the last second, they told us to move forward, and so here we are. We got a lot to talk about, but Ian, welcome back. Why don't we start with that? How you been, Thanks. Man?
I've been doing pretty well. Feel like I'm finally out of my, I had a long COVID slump where I was feeling pretty blue, but since about the fall, I've been feeling better, and it's been nice, so I'm excited for baseball.
Yeah, and what's your optimism level right now for the Mets?
You know, I think that we have a legitimate chance to win the World Series, but I am concerned a little bit about just kind of the loss of momentum with Diaz going down and the Braves looking, you know, very good. But I'm hopeful. I'm really hopeful. I hope we come out the gate like hitting the ball well. I think the fact that Lindor and Alonso played in the WBC is going to be really helpful for us. Oh, and McNeil played in the WBC as well. So I think all of that will be helpful.
How many games do you go to a year?
I've had different levels. When I first moved back to New York, my friend was working for the Mets. He was like an early sabermetrics guy, and he would give me tickets, and I was probably going to 20 plus games a year, often for free and sitting like in a Metropolitan box. I would say, well, let's just say that since last year, I probably went to 6 or 7, 4 of them with Alfie as a 2-year-old hanging out with me in the stands. And she really loves it. She loves Mr. Met. So my hope is that we're going to build on that this year and go to even more.
This year she will love Pete Alonso instead of Mr. Met.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fine if she loves Pete Alonso, but I mean, if she loves Mr. Met, but like she loves the trumpets too. So that's kind of a bummer.
Do you try to get a whole game in with her, or are you like, if I make it 5 innings, that's a win?
So the way it works is we usually go post nap. So if she sleeps till like 2:30 or 3, we've arrived in the 5th inning, you know. One time we were going to go for Jorve's birthday party, which was Alfie's first game, but we didn't make it till the bottom of the 7th. And Jeff and I passed each other as he was leaving and we were arriving. But I have one game. She made it through the whole game. You know, it depends on who she's with. If she's with me, she'll like sit in the stands and like, you know, eat on my lap and like watch the game and clap. But if my wife's there, she just wants to wander around the concourse and run everywhere. So it really depends on the, you know, the vibe.
Totally. I think it's like, this is where I really did get brought on board to the changes that baseball was making. Cause it's too slow for kids. Yeah. And I don't know what was different when we were kids. Cause I remember just being totally fixated on everything when I was 5 and 6 and got to go to a game. It also might've just been how rare it was that I got to go, but I remember going to Shea, cause you know, I grew up in New York, Ian, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What town did you grow up in?
I was in Manhattan. I grew up 86th in New York.
Did you go to high school in New York?
I did. Yeah, I went to collegiate.
Oh, you went to collegiate, huh?
Yeah.
This guy probably went to like Regis or something.
No. I don't really consider myself a real New Yorker, though, honestly. Yeah. Like once I got out, I was like, I'm never really going back there. I did have a stint in Brooklyn, as I think you know, but mm-hmm. That was the extent of it. I do miss Shea in the weirdest of ways. Like, do you miss Shea at all, or are you just like City so much
better? I mean, I like at City Field that you sit closer. That the circle at Shea was huge. But speaking of going to Shea as a kid, I remember being like 6 or 7 years old, and maybe I was and my dad and I were going to go to a true doubleheader, Mets Cubs in July. And like the whole ride out, I was like, we got to stay the full 18. You know, I probably didn't talk that way. I was like, I want to stay for both games. You know, I want to stay for both games. So, you know, it's like early 90s Mets, you know, Strawberry's still on the team. Hernandez is still on the team, you know, still a very good team. And by the, like, probably the third inning of the first game, I was like, I'm done. Let's go home. but I've seen some epic games at Shea. Like, you know, when I was in law school, I went a fair bit and saw, I saw like one where we won when we were down 9-1 in the bottom of the eighth inning or something like that. So I've seen some great games at Shea, and, but I do really like Citi Field. And I think it is an upgrade. So,
Chris, I feel like you failed to do your research here and failing to point out that I also used to go to Shea when I lived in New Jersey as a kid and went to the first probably 20 baseball games in my life at Shea.
Wow, I really had no idea.
But you don't care. You don't care. You didn't bother to ask.
You know, like so far, I'm demoting you to, you know, equals with me as a co-commissioner. And I'm also, you know, I'm fumbling it everywhere here today. But yeah, no. I really, you know what I miss about Shea is the way that it used to shake, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like, that's the thing. Like, when you were at a game at Shea, I remember I was at game six of the 2006 playoffs where the...
You saw the Endy catch?
No, that's game seven.
Yeah, that's game seven.
Okay. Game six was the one where Carpenter was on the mound for the Cardinals, and everyone's like, it's a done deal. Like, you can't beat Chris Carpenter. And I think the Mets won 4-0, or maybe the Cardinals scored two in the ninth, and it was 4-2. I honestly can't remember. The building was shaking the entire time I was there. I was like actually half terrified and half impressed. But that building shook like no other stadium that I can recall.
I love the neon guys on the exterior. I just always thought that was very cool. I wish that they had incorporated that into Citi Field, but you know, Wilpons were big Brooklyn Dodgers thumpers. So instead we have a replica of Ebbets Field, which has nothing to do with the Mets, but it's still nice.
It is a really great stadium, but I hear you on that. All right. Well, and family's good. We'll move on from that, but family's good.
Yeah, we're hanging in. You know, we're hanging in.
Mama Donna still crushing the poker tables?
Oh, my God. She's still, you know, the funny thing about her is that she's now been playing for like 3 years, and she still doesn't understand that if you don't have anything and you're calling your money off, it's not bluffing. It's like, you have to be the one to bet. But, you know, I'm working with her on it. And
well, hasn't she won it once?
Yeah, there's been a couple times where I've been sitting next to her and helping her out if I was like...
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, gentlemen, to our listeners, we've got a fun show planned for you guys here. As you might imagine, it's only a few days after the auction has been completed. Matt and Ian have been working tirelessly for us to provide us content. It's all amazing to read. Thank you both. I think we're going to just have a little bit of a discussion about the draft because this was a funky one, and we can take it any way you want. I'm going to try to sort of, you know, prime the two of you up a little bit, and then I'll chime in, but mostly get out of your way and let you have your thoughts. So, Star, you've been very quiet. Maybe we'll start with you on this. General thoughts about the draft. What'd you think of this one?
You know, I don't think it was like crazy funky. I just think it was a little, I think, quirky. I think there were weird values to be had in the really expensive guys, and then in like the, you know, $10 and less crowd, that we got a bunch of guys who went for like the men who like easily could, I thought maybe would go for like 8-10, and then like the middle tier of players all went for like the right price or more than I thought they were going to go for. And I don't really understand why it happened that way. But I think in the end, what we saw is a lot more money left on the board than we've ever seen in a while. And so I feel like, I guess the normally priced and overpriced guys certainly were canceled out by the values that were had like at the high and low ends.
Ian, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was very surprised that there wasn't more competition at the top of the starting pitching market. I thought that was going to be a knockdown, brutal fight, with guys who I thought would go in the mid-40s creep up into the 50s, and guys who I thought would go in the mid-30s would creep up into the 40s. But instead, nearly everyone who went everyone who went in the top of the pitching market went for less than I expected, which cascaded down to the rest of the draft, and that's in part why we have money left over. And then the decisions that were made in relation to those pitchers, the ones that had RFAs and weren't matched on, was very surprising to me as well.
One thing that I found really interesting, not that I don't know that anyone would have been able to really make this change on the fly, but I didn't notice how much money was left on the board and actually realized that it was going to get stuck there until about 2 hours left to go in the draft. And I'd be curious if like any of the owners actually legitimately did see this coming, like, and like with pivoted in some way after an hour or two. Yeah. Okay. Well, both Ian and Star are being like, yep, me, I was. So like, how'd you change?
Notice we didn't have any money left over.
Well, you know, I, as you might remember, I mock draft a lot. I fill out the auction sheet, like, you know, dozens of times in advance. And I was ending up with money left over with prices way higher than some of these guys went for. So, you know, I came in with a fixed strategy. I knew that unless they went over $120 million combined, which I thought was unlikely, I was going to match on both Judge and Betts. And when I got them for $90 million combined, the guys who I was debating on as my possible, you know, one extra splurge became, I can get both, or I can maybe pivot and try to pay for one more big guy. I ended up going that route, but as a result, I was able to withdraw my conditional promotions. But, you know, I think that some people really got caught flat-footed, and you can tell by their roster construction, because then they started throwing $15, $16 million at players that I think could have gone for $3 or $4 million.
Star, I know you had something to say there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just kind of surprised with all the money that was left on the board, how many deals there were at the end of the draft. That confused me more than anything, is that like all these guys who, you know, not like anyone special, but like tons of guys, like good relievers, like decent, like, you know, bench bats, back of the road, less so much the starting pitching, but I would say more with the offense and the relievers, that like no one was bidding these guys up. And I was like, guys, everyone has money. Why are you just like letting everyone have all these players for the min when like, you know, these are $5 players and you have a ton of money left over? I didn't understand that part of it. I was not in a position to be bidding anybody up. I was certainly glad to be giving all these guys who I thought were $5 million players for the min, but I thought that was a weird phenomenon at the end of the draft that no one was doing that.
Yeah, I think the thing about that is, number one, you and I are probably the most active price enforcers, and we stayed pretty steady throughout. We weren't really trying to get caught with guys that we didn't necessarily want. I think the other thing to say to that about the relievers is that there are a lot of high quality relievers, and I think that, like, I don't think, like, for example, I'm trying to think, like, Adam Ottavino to Anton went for $4 million. Like, I'd be just as happy with a bunch of guys who came at the min. So it's a question of like, okay, well, here's my list of relievers. I'm looking at the pitcher list, save hold list, and there are still 30 guys available in the top 60. Like, I'm not going to bid up any of these guys. And I think probably some people had a similar mentality. But the other thing that happened is that people filled their rosters pretty early as compared to some other teams, and didn't come back in when there was more values available. They just held, which I might not have done that if I felt like I needed to improve my team and I had the cash to drop a guy for $1 million.
I also wonder, to the extent that Ryan doing this last year, like ending the year with a bunch of cash and then being able to convert it into a competing team, I wonder to the extent that, you know, teams have now thought like it'd be nice to end the draft with 25 plus million. I think the number of teams that have north of 20 stunned me, but I definitely saw it as a luxury that I've never had in my entire time in LDB. And so like once I made the trade with Ryan, I was like, this is sweet. Like, I don't have to worry about anything. I want a player. I go get him. I'm not like budgeting. And then
you living know, like bought- Brophy.
Yeah, bought a pick. Like I do think, like, even going into this year, I don't know that it'll be like this every year, but I said to VJ before it began, I really want to have 10 at the end. Like, if we can have 10, that will make me feel very comfortable that we're in the right position. Ended up with closer to 15, which, you know, I think that was just the nature of the way that the draft played out. But I do see your point about relievers being somewhat interchangeable. I think that one thing that I was expecting that didn't really happen is that there, some of those top guys also have starting pitching eligibility, which if you're trying to pull the strategy that, you know, you want as many relief pitchers, hit the innings floor and then just kind of sit there, those guys are worth more. So, and I didn't see them go for more. There wasn't that premium, and that surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And maybe I haven't looked at it closely enough, but I didn't see anyone who went like super hard on that strategy either, though, unless I missed something.
You mean the thing that I used, that I've done 1 year.
Right. And I know you've done it, Chris, and Becker
Chris
has done it.
And Becker have done it. The three of us have done it. But
yeah,
well, Anton went high end reliever instead of adding any starting pitching, but I don't think anybody else approached the strategy of going like, I'm going to have eight guys, who are RPs every day.
Honest to God, I was gunning for the eight RP strategy, and then I pivoted when I saw that I could get the starting pitchers that I wanted at value. So that changed me a little. I think I exited the draft with seven, and two of them are starting pitcher eligible. But that gives me flexibility, because now I have the guys that I want, and I can adapt on the fly, because you can always pick up good relievers as the season goes on.
Well, so that's the other thing, is that, you know, some of the best relievers were available late, and I thought they were going to go for the bin. So I didn't feel like the need to like push for kind of like more multi-inning guys when I could possibly end up with, you know, higher leverage guys for cheaper.
Yeah. Well, we sort of pivoted to the second thing that I wanted to ask the two of you about, and I really do intend to get out of your way, both of you, on this one. Star, let's start with you, but I'm curious, like, when you map out, because Ian sort of already started to tell us his thoughts on this, when you start to map things out, how much do you go into the draft just looking for value versus how much do you go into the draft with a particular plan of, like, I'm coming home with this guy, and, like, I'm going to get, like, someone from this tier? Like, what's your strategy in terms of the way that you look at a draft before it begins?
Yeah, I can start, I guess. I don't know. I've done it kind of a weird thing the last 2 years, which I have filled my roster and pretty severely before the draft. And so I, in a way, almost kind of, like, hem myself into certain strategies, and that, like, the last 2 years I've had not a lot of money and only a few roster spots to fill. And so I'm kind of stuck in a way. Like, I felt like this draft, I was like, well, you know, I have 90 million and I could use some star bats, because that's really it. I only really have three starting spots. So I got to spend on second base, third base, and center field. And that was pretty much what I locked myself into just by virtue of the roster that I had. I didn't really have any other way out of that. So that was kind of my strategy, just kind of by default. It was kind of all I had available to me. And that's been kind of what I've done the last 2 years, for better or for worse. But I feel like it's worked out the last two times. I've gotten the guys I wanted, the prices I wanted. I don't want to overpay, but, you know, I try to give myself a range for, you know, I want, you know, I like this subset of players, try to figure out, you know, who's the best value within that subset of players. But I kind of feel like I locked myself into, you know, a certain group of players that I was choosing from here.
Yeah. So Matt and I have been in a preseason arms race for the past, since I've stopped selling and started buying again. We're both trying to build a strong roster preseason, and we've kind of taken on similar tactics, although now my homegrown roster is far deeper than his. You know, he got McClanahan at the minimum, though, which really helps him to, and of course Burns is, you know, probably one of the best values in the entire league, if not the. But I'll talk about this generally. What I do now is I kind of make like, if this happens, then this happens charts. So I have a first group, which is going to be the most expensive, and I fill my biggest need from that group. So In this draft, I felt like I had two choices. I could either go high-end offense, or I can build up my pitching more. Because although Verlander is a solid SP1, it's true that like none of my other guys are like on that level, and I'd be working from a pool of like threes. And I game both of those things out. You know, I felt that pitching would be more expensive than they were. If I knew that Darvish was going to go for 30, I wouldn't have sold the RFAs, because maybe I could have squeezed it in. But I thought he'd go for $5 to even $10 million more than that, given the way that he's come up on the rankings and how high he was ranked. So I think that first tier. And then what I do is I, you know, just make an Excel sheet where I make a chart of the position needs that I have. So let's say center field, right field, U1, SP2. I put my roster like, instead of the way it is on the draft board, kind of like how you would imagine it as like a full roster, like SP1, SP2, SP3, SP4, SP5, RP1, RP2, and my IL spots. And I say, okay, who could fit in where? So I knew that I wasn't comfortable with any of the guys I had as a regular center fielder or right fielder, and I didn't really have an SP2. So I start with center field, and I'm like, okay. Initially, I thought Byron Buxton would make sense in center field. I bought his RFA rights, and then I started gaming out how much Buxton would cost. And I thought I could go anywhere from $15 to $20 million. I was surprised I ended up going for $27. So then I subtract that amount, and I say, okay, next position. And I think about it from the perspective of the high. I never allow myself to think about what my team would look like if I get the guy I wanted as a bargain. And I just do that step by step until I fill the roster. And then I eliminate that chart and I start again going with a different strategy until I land on the one that makes the most logical sense for me, going across from left to right until the roster is full. And I've started to really work on practicing leaving money over, which was something I was bad at in the beginning and I wanted to avoid in the future.
So one of the things that I'm finding particularly intriguing from this is the two of you have, I'm going to call it different but similar strategies in terms of the way that you go about your draft. You know what you need to get. You've thought about it in advance. You may not be locked into a guy, but you have like paths that you can take. I feel like Brophy drafts the other way. Mm-hmm. You know, Brophy's like, these are my values and I'm going to let everybody like charge out the gate and I'm going to wait and I'm going to be deadly in the mid tier. And like, you know, when everybody's lost the money and they start to worry, I'm going to have more than everybody else and I'm going to get every single guy that I want that's a sleeper and I'm going to get them at value. You know, it was kind of funny in this draft. I don't mind saying this. I said it to his face already or over text, whatever it was. But I said I nominated guys that I was trying to get Brophy to spend on in the mid tier. Like when I named
like Bello Brian, and Ashcraft.
Yeah, when I named Bello, I was like, this will be a sneaky time to get Brophy to overpay if I do it in the silent auction, because I knew that he was going to want him. And I knew that he would kind of freak out on the valuation. And I ended up being, you know, I was hoping he'd spend $5 million more than he did. But I think at the, you know, there's a little bit of like trying to anticipate the Brophys in the league. One of the things that I found so intriguing about the way that this particular draft played out, though, was that there were a number of teams that I thought could have gone in any number of directions. I count myself among them. And so like watching the way that I think we all sort of went out the gate, like, all right, well, let's see where the value is. And we were trying to feel each other out and there was value freaking everywhere because no one was gunning for a guy. I think that's really what happened. I did not go into this draft. I know, Star, you told me you thought I was going to end up bidding for DeGrom. I was price enforcing.
I thought DeGrom was a great fit for your team. I thought that was perfect. But it's nice that that wasn't the strategy and it worked out.
Well, I said to VJ, you know, we need to get two of the stars, two of the top 15 players in this draft with the amount of money that we had. And I was like, I don't care if it's a pitcher. I don't care if it's a shortstop and a third baseman. I don't care if it's an outfielder, but we need to get two. And let's see if we can find the value. I don't know that I got value on Bregman, but I was probably a little too jumpy at the beginning, but then.
And that price was fine. I think I had it like 30 or 31. It's not like you overpaid drastically or anything.
No, but if you told me that I could have had Trey Turner at like, what was it? $7 million more. I would have done that in a heartbeat. But I think the flip side is that with DeGrom, I have him in the top, you know, seven, eight players, whatever it was in the draft that I could have gotten. And I didn't want Brophy landing DeGrom at like $40 million. So I was like, you know, if it gets to 50, I'll back off. I got him at 45. So like, it was just like, that was kind of how the whole thing played out.
I just wanted to reiterate why I thought DeGrom was such a good fit for you, for your team. I thought your team has a lot of potential, a lot of young guys, and was kind of like, you know, before the auction kind of came in, that like on the fringes of contention. And I was like, you know, you got a guy like DeGrom is like the ultimate like leap. You know, it's the upside is so high. And for a team that's like right on the fringes that needs like a home run, like a guy like that is perfect. Because if you draft conservatively, you might just miss the playoffs anyway. So why not take that home run? You know, and if he gets hurt or you fail, you know, then so be it. You might miss the playoffs anyway.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. But going back to the Brophy strategy, I feel like Brophy drafts for K contracts. I think he's trying to anticipate who he wants to have at low cost. And I could be wrong. I wish I had him here to ask him. But that's what I anticipate. I think Nate's really good at that too. I think Nate tends to be very good at trying to draft guys that he can keep. You know, I've seen a lot of value from Nate over the years. Do you guys ever try to draft for value in that regard? Or is that just something you let go of completely and figure that out later?
So I want to first respond to what you said about Brophy and comparing him to me and Matt. Brophy has something that Matt and I do not have, which is patience. You know, what I realize is that Brophy treats it as he has $170 million every year, and that 30 is to extract future value. And then you don't have to worry about spending $50 million on a pitcher because you've got that guy as a homegrown. And he's spending the money 4 years before Matt and I are trying to like scrape out everything we can get, you know, with a 2025 pick. So right. I think that's right. Because Brophy is developing. He's like, you know, the Rays, but you know, and, I think that Matt and I, you know, Matt is more successful at this because he hasn't really had to burn it all to the ground, but like, we're just trying to get maximum value in the current season. And we'll worry about the next season until we're not able to, until we have to finally pay the bill.
Can I say one thing on that real quick before you move on? Just while we're talking about this, I said this to Brophy after the draft, and I'm sure this is going to blow up in my face because, you know, it Brophy never fails. But I do feel like this year, there Brophy had so many roster spots filled and so much money that it actually favored a more now strategy for him that he did not capitalize on. I think I feel like he could have done more with what he had than what he did. Like, he should have gone for one more star than he did in this draft. I felt like there was an opportunity there that he didn't take because he had so much flexibility, and I feel like he played it like a typical Brophy draft, and I feel like it was not, and it was more of an anomalous year for him than, and he couldn't pivot. I feel like he just played it like he normally does.
Well, that's the thing that's surprising to me about that. And I don't mind, you know, I still think he has the best team and he's going to be ranked as number one in the power ranking. Spoiler alert.
I wanted to say to that, the ATC projections now say my team is better than his team. And coming into the auction, there was no way I thought that would have been possible based on what the projections say. I was like, there's no way that anyone's going to catch him. And I caught him, and I don't know if that shouldn't have happened.
Well, that's what I was going to say, which is maybe a bold statement, but I think he had a bad draft. And let me tell you why. You know, he owned Wheeler's RFAs, and Wheeler went for $37 million. To me, that is an insta match. And he could have had Turner at 42 and he had $192 million. I don't understand why you settle for Bogarts at 28 when you have the ability to go to 43 on Turner without breaking a sweat. You know, he said to me when we were talking, I always talk to people about, oh, this is what I think you're going to do. He's like, I'm wary about, you know, I actually penciled in Matt Olson and Brandon Lowe almost exactly at the prices they had. So that made sense to me. But when I say bad, I don't mean like, oh, it was a shitty, terrible draft, because I like, you know, especially I liked having the Bueller at 16. I think that's actually really good for the future. But I just don't understand why he has $28 million and has an injured Joe Musgrove and Xander Bogaerts for 1 year when he could have had a truly elite player in both of those spots and really continue to separate from the rest of the pack.
And so it's 2020, right? I think when as we look at what that Bueller contract is going to do to us in future years, I think we'll look back on this moment and it'll be a little funny. But at the same time, I agree with you.
I think it's not going to do anything. He's had a second Tommy John surgery. Walker Bueller will never be the same again. That's my take. Hot take right now.
Yeah.
Well, no. I said it as a positive thing. So I don't just agree with Star there. The other thing I'll say is like Graham Ashcraft, who throws, you know, super hard, of course, you're paying $10 million for that breakout. And then you're paying 16. How many paid for Bello? 7.5. That's a little bit better, but like, you know, I'd rather
it's Bayo.
I'm terrible at pronouncing these guys' names. I just would have preferred, just like you said, Matt, that he spent more on consensus ranked top guys. You know?
So we've started to pivot to talk about specific teams, which I think is what we wanted to do next. And I'm going to call this the who killed it part of the draft. Do you guys mind if I go first and then I'll get out of your way? Cause I think you guys sure. do so much more analysis than I do. Sorry if I'm stealing your thunder, but no, Ray, if you're listening, you win. I think Ray won the draft. And I think he won the draft with exactly what we've talked about. So it's not exactly news. I don't know how much we really need to go into depths here, but he walked out of the draft with Darvish at 30. He walked out of the draft with Trey Turner at 42, which I think is an insane steal. In fact, the fact that he did that and still had Bobby Witt coming up is just great. I like Albies at 18. I don't know how much of a savings that is, but it was a nice fit for his team. Nola at 42. I mean, the way that this draft shook out for him, there was and honestly, I like Wood at 9. The only thing I didn't like was Berrios at 12, and that's just because I'm really down on the guy. But I think
that was a fine price. It's not like
it's a fine price. I just don't like the guy. Like it's yeah. So you know, but I think in terms of if you would have penciled, you know, in the a perfect draft for Ray, this is it. I don't think he could have done any better. So I challenge you to poke a hole in that balloon.
Well, I don't know. If you read my power rankings, I agreed with you. You know, what I read is my first sentence. I said Ray had a great auction. I agree. I think that if you're going to say, you know, I think what Ray was able to do was go from seller to contender. You know, I think he's going to compete for a wild card with his draft. He didn't make any big mistakes. In terms of who won the draft, I mean, I probably did because I got Aaron Judge and Mookie Betts for $90 million.
It's very annoying.
Star couldn't get over it. I'm so happy about it. I think you just leave that in a vacuum. You know, like the rest doesn't almost matter. You got two of the top five players for a significant savings for a team that was already pretty well stacked up. But putting myself aside, and I could, you know, analyze my team further.
It's okay. You got the floor. Go for it.
Yeah. I mean, I just think, you know, my view was that if I could get them both, which I knew that I could after I bought Judge's RFA rights, I was going to try to fill it out with high OBP guys to make sure the rates stayed good and got Winker and Myers. And then Ben Attendee fell into my lap for $3.5 million. Not like he's a star, but he should have been at least $10 million. And then Marcana for $1 million. So I'm happy with it. You know, the weakness that I expected to walk away with, like no clear SP2 still exists. But I think it gives me a fighting chance against Star, which is all I really want at this stage. And we'll see how it shakes out. But putting myself aside, I think that I agree that Ray, had an excellent draft. And I think the other person who, Paul did what he had to do, which is that he had to get Freeman back, and he got it back at a reasonable price. So that was good. And then I liked the Bryant addition, especially at $18 million. I thought that was that was totally fine. I also like Montgomery at 17 as opposed to Pablo Lopez at 23. If you would have told me there would be a $6 million spread between these two players, I would have taken Montgomery. The other person that I wanted to mention in terms of having who I thought did what they set out to do was you, Chris. You know, I thought you were going to go big at third base. I actually thought Jose Ramirez was like calling your name, but Bregman makes sense at 32. And then to get Teoscar at 27 and Cron at 15, you really shored up that offense. And then, you know, I certainly felt like Flaherty at 7-5, if he wasn't a Cardinal, you would have cut him. So it was nice to see Jacob deGrom fall to you at that price. And then it doesn't make sense to me that Mark doesn't match at 45 if his goal is to play for next year, because you could swap deGrom for excellent keeper contracts at that price as long as he's healthy. I didn't understand it. I just don't understand how you don't match below 50 on Jacob deGrom.
I was pleased that he didn't. And I feel like as we've already said, my draft will basically, it's make or break on whether deGrom stays healthy. Let's talk about Mark's draft for a second, though, because I don't.
Wait, I didn't get to do my good draft.
Yes, my apologies. Yeah, I was. You're right. Go for it, and then.
I'm going to talk about Shea Stadium for 10 minutes. I'm just kidding.
I'm putting a pin in Mark because I got something to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I have this from a pure numbers perspective. I think the reality is what looked like the good drafts were the good drafts. I had numbers on teams, you know, projected before the draft and after the draft, and the three teams that made the biggest improvements in the auction were you two and Ray. There was no real competition. It was the three of you made the biggest improvements from kind of where your standing was pre-auction to where you are now in terms of your ability. You know, I thought Ian was a good team, but I thought a ways back from the top, he has now put himself, you know, into, you know, easily top three, you know, conversation, top two conversation. I think you and Ray both were kind of, I had you in kind of the fringy contenders place. You're now, you know, fourth best in federal, pretty easily. And then Ray, I had kind of out of competition now in the playoff mix. And those were the big changes, I think. So you know, all three of you guys seem to have a strong plan and accomplish exactly what you were trying to do. So kudos to all of you for, you know, at least right now looks like, you know, great moves in this auction.
It's funny. I don't feel like I had a great auction because I wanted to walk away with a value with like more values. And I feel like DeGrom's my only really good value. But I do want to talk about Mark's, for a moment, if that's okay.
Yeah. You know, I have some things to say about Mark too. But
Mark's playing a different game. I feel like this is the old checkers chess thing, right? And like, it's been that way for years. This is the one where I'm just going to finally come out and say it straight up. I don't understand this because I feel like he could easily win Iron and Oil. It's the weakest division in our league. I don't think it's particularly close. Anton and I were both kind of down and out going into this year. Dorby's team is very good, but I think it's beatable. So the strategy to like go out and get these guys that are going to be late season additions, it's very Mark, because if he can hang around, then all of a sudden his team's going to be much, much, much better in the second half than the first. In particular, I think getting Altuve is probably pretty smart but you know, thumbs can sap your power. Which is that on his left or his right hand? I actually don't even know. Do you guys know?
I don't know the answer to that.
Because I imagine if it's on the wrong hand, it's going to really sap his power this year, at least, because you need your thumb. And even if he comes back like pretty strong, like that's risky. Who is the other guy that he got that is injured?
He paid 9.5, too much money.
Yeah.
But Harper was fine at 30. I like the price.
I think he's built now to be absolutely, if not the best, you know, in the top two next year. So it's hard to argue with that, except that I think he could have afforded to be top two this year and next year. So I don't fully get it.
That would be my complaint with it. And I think that's why it was an odd decision. I mean, who knows? I say Mark looks like he's punting this year, but he always made it.
Ian, did you lose Star there, or am I the only one who lost him?
I did. I lost him. He's frozen.
All right. While he's frozen, I'll turn it over to you. You have any thoughts on this, or should we start talking about a new team?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just talk about it from a different perspective, which is that, you know, as I've gotten older, I just want it to be as fun as possible. And this waiting when you don't have to me doesn't seem very fun. Sure, you could maximize Julio Rodriguez's value, but how much more fun would it be to just watch him play every day and accrue stats for you, you know, and watch the greatest pitcher of his generation when healthy, Jacob DeGrom, pitch for you, which he could have guaranteed for himself. So I just kind of wished for him that he would allow himself that joy, you know, especially coming off a pennant, you know.
I'm gonna push back, because if I took one thing away from the cast that we had him on, it's this. I think he's having an amazing time right now. Like, I think he likes doing it this way, right? So yeah. Like I don't know that you're right, because just the prospect gives him something. And his dream, I remember him saying it, was I'm gonna have a team that is filled with H and S contracts, and that's the dream. And I think he's moving towards it. So like,
well, yeah, but is he? He's also going away from it. Look at how many of these guys have busted. I am pretty much there. I have the most useful homegrowns, I think, in the history of LDB, right? Like on my team every single day. You know, Lowe, Jimenez.
What? In terms of value, you have quantity. You don't have, I think Brophy has got you beat. Yeah. I think.
No, that's right. Quantity. I'm just talking about quantity. Like, if you want to look at a team where that you see H and S a lot, you could look at the box. And you know, I did that in 2 years, and like I think that it was lucky. You know, Lowe worked out in a way that I didn't necessarily expect him to, and Jimenez did also. It's good to sometimes trust your gut and not trust Matt Starr's evaluation of prospects. Because he and I have disagreed about some of these guys, including Albies in the past. And I'm glad that, you know, I ended up getting them. But
if I've learned one thing over the years, is that I am terrible at evaluating prospects. That is not my strength.
Is that right? I didn't know you felt that way about yourself. I mean, you've gotten a lot of good guys.
Well, he's good at selling them, Ian. That's the thing. It's like they never stay on his team. They're gone within 16 minutes. So,
Anybody want a broken Austin Martin? Give me a call.
I think Matt Starr treats his prospects like Hot Pockets. They come out of the microwave, and he doesn't want to hold them anymore. So, like that's pretty much where we're at. I do think I want to make sure.
I think that's fair. I guess that goes to just my projection of what I want versus what someone else might want. So that's true.
You know. Star, you're going to have to trust us, though, that we talked about Mark's team and you lost your chance. And I'm going to give you instead.
No, I had things to say and I wanted to say it. It wasn't so much about Mark. I wanted to call out the other owners in Iron and Oil for allowing Mark to do this shit and still make the playoffs, because he had no business either last year. I mean, last year his team was very average and he should not have. I mean, he lucked into the playoffs and then he lucked his way into the finals, and you know, it is what it is, but that was not a good team. That just team that happened to make it to the finals because he had a shit division. So other Iron and Oil owners, this is on you. Fix your shit. Jeff Jorvey in particular, who can't manage his team during the regular season. Let's capitalize on the talent you have and not let this keep happening.
Oh man, those are some words, Star. harsh words.
I'll say it. You know, from the more gentle co-commissioner side of things, you know, Mark had one of the most dominant top heavy starting pitchers groups in the history of LDB last year, and he was rewarded for it.
He did, but he finished like with a 500 record, and he only had those pitchers as a group at the end of the season. And there's no reason that record should have gotten him into the gotten him a bye in the playoffs.
To be fair, you can't really criticize Anton last year. I mean, Anton
criticize Jeff Jorvie in particular.
Well, and I think we've talked about how I sold very, very quickly last year, and that was the topic of many casts. There's a few teams we haven't touched on, and we've been on for about 50 minutes. We probably have about 10 to go. I want to make sure we give everybody a little bit of love. I'm curious, and Star, if you want to go first on this one, feel free. But what do you think of Dubner's draft? Did you give any thought to it?
Let me take a look. Give me a second. I don't have it.
If we only have 10 minutes left, I suggest we like hit every team so that everyone gets to hear about our views on them.
All right. Well, I mean,
Dubner, I thought his draft was fine. I don't have anything particularly positive or negative. I think it's weird to me that a team with those three, with Soto and Alvarez and Guerrero on it, is going to end up as like the fourth or fifth best offense. I don't know how you let that happen. I feel like he kind of weirdly let those guys get surrounded with scrubs again, which was kind of the problem last season. And he didn't, I thought maybe he would buy another bat. That would, I feel like maybe there was a lesson to be learned from struggles last year that he didn't learn. That would be my one complaint, but it was fine. I don't know. He kind of treaded water in terms of, value.
Fair enough. Ian, I'm giving you warning so you can chime in on a team as well that we haven't really talked too much about. Maybe you can cover Ryan's in a second. But I want to say I was intrigued by Sean's strategy in this draft. I don't dislike it. I'm just going to go out and say that. I think there's two ways to go about drafting when you are rebuilding. One is to go out and get stars to trade. And I think Sean took a more optimistic approach because his rebuild has gone so well. And I think he went for K contract values. And I think he got some. I'm not quite sure which ones are going to be the ones that we talk about a year from now, but there's plenty of players on this team that I think he did pretty well. There's a chance Josh Bell at 14 looks decent. I like the chance of Mondesi being pretty good. And Stanton at 20, like if he goes on one of his power binges, Conforto at 8.5. Pretty much what I think he did was he just went out and he got a number of players that they're either not going to be worth what he paid or they're going to be major values. And Sandoval is the other one that stands out to me. Having had him, he has, top 40 pitching potential. He also might be nothing. So I appreciate the way that Sean went about this. If we had him here, I'd ask him if that's what he was going for, but there's no major star that he came home with on this one. And I appreciate that that's his angle. Ian, are you ready to talk about Ryan's for a minute?
Sure. I mean, I think the first thing you said about what you said about Josh Bell, I totally agree with. I didn't understand why Ryan didn't match a Josh Bell at 14 million. I tried to trade for Bell's RFAs and Ryan wasn't interested. And so what price are you keeping him at? 14 would have been probably to me the low end of where you would expect him to go. And I think that's just emblematic of his odd decisions during this auction. Now, let's start with the positive. I really like Rasmussen. I thought that of the guys who didn't have RFAs, like spending 26 on him was totally fine. I also really like Whitlock at 8. I think that the relievers that he got should be quite solid. People are talking about what I called him lasagna during the draft, but Lozogia is really going to be probably really high quality this year. But after that, he made this decision where it was clear to me that he was trying to maximize position eligibility flexibility with Paradis. How do you say his last name? Is that it?
Paradis.
Yeah, Donovan Estrada. But then didn't fill out the bench with enough hitters for that to make any sense. If they were going to have to play every day, what does it matter what their position eligibility is? Because they're going to have to be in the lineup somewhere and those stats are going to accrue. If you have a deep bench of hitters and you're going to play matchups, that's a possibility. And maybe he can fill that out from the waiver wire, but I'd rather have steady guys that can play every day that are good. You know, Donovan, he was definitely a target of mine. I was hoping to pay five or less. He paid 9.5. I do not understand Paradis at 16 at all. And then going with Estrada at 15 with those two guys feels a bit redundant. So I hope that he takes this as constructive criticism, but I did not like the auction.
I mean, from a, based on my numbers perspective, you know, where he was before the auction to where he was after the auction, Ryan had the worst auction. Like he fell the furthest, and I had him as a fringe competitor, kind of neck and neck with Becker for fourth best in Union, and he is not even close to Becker and fell behind Ray. But that didn't need to happen. So at least the projections do not believe that this is a good draft. My opinion aside, projections seem to think that this was about as bad a draft as you could have had.
I don't think it was the worst draft, but it was a bad draft.
It was the worst draft amongst the 16 teams.
So I might give it to Nate. I don't know.
All right, let's talk about Nate.
But Nate wasn't really, I guess with Nate, he wasn't really in a position to compete to begin with. So it was going to be, it was less impactful for him to have a rough draft. Like Ryan drafted himself out of the playoffs, in my opinion.
I think the thing to note about what happened to Nate, which I think is really unfortunate to him, is that I actually don't object to him ending the draft with $32 million if everybody else finished with five.
Right.
That would have been great. The problem was that there was way too much money. And so using the Ryan strategy from last year of like, let's see if I can overcompete and then buy something, or, you know, buy a series of picks or maybe a prospect or whatever. It's not a bad rebuild strategy if that's what you're going for. The problem is that there's so much money left over that I think it cheapens the value of what he has. Both in next year's draft, if we bring a record amount of money to the draft next year, but also in terms of if somebody goes out there right now and says, I'm willing to sell a third round pick, it's not going to go for $7 million. I tell you that right now.
No, it's not. This is, I think, the first draft I can remember where no one sold a pick, you know?
Right. That's what I'm saying. I think it's going to be way inflated prices, and that's going to hurt our rebuilders. So anybody in particular you want to talk about on Nate's draft that you like? Or
no, it's not that I actually don't know if his draft was worse than Ryan's. I'm just really bothered by the decision to not add pitching, because it just doesn't allow him to have an avenue to compete. Like, I like the Nimmo price at 10. I like Gonzalez at 4.5. I think Seager's gonna have a huge year, so he's a fine centerpiece of the offense to go along with Alonso. But to have $32 million and have Ross Stripling and Carlos Carrasco as your aces, I just think you're going to have a bad time. And it's possible that he set himself up for a position to take a huge McQueenie hit if he sells with the depth of the starting staff.
Yeah, I think the criticism that you said of Brophy's earlier is the same here, right? It's like there was room for a star. Instead of Carrasco, you could have had Wheeler, you could have had Nola, you could have had DeGrom, and then you have $10 million left, and then the draft makes a heck of a lot more sense.
Oh yeah, it's a much different team, right?
Right. So I agree, but I think rebuilding strategy is different, and if there was a strategy of trying to have money at the end, like, I just think he got a little screwed by the way that this whole thing played out. So we haven't talked about Becker.
One more positive thing about Becker and Tim. One more positive thing about Nate, which is that the lower price keeper contracts look kind of good. Like, there's some guys there that could totally outperform their value. It's just, I don't know if they're going to be doing it right out of the jump. All right, Becker. Yeah.
Well, first, hey, we're going to talk about the tones. All right, Becker. Yeah. I know you're listening, and we're going to talk about the tones right now. Okay, and you're going to have to live with that. So, all right, Star and Ian, you have any thoughts on what Becker did? Did he hold serve?
Yeah, I thought Becker had a good draft. I mean, I don't think there's anything particularly, you know, outstanding about his draft, but I think, I don't know if it's, he held serve I'm looking at his guys right now. I think he held serve. He, you know, he got a great value in Santana, or in Perez, sorry. He doesn't have a first baseman, which is kind of a mess. He has two guys as his first baseman that I literally owned and dropped last year, in Carlos Santana and G-Man Choi. That's not where I'd want to be. And it's weird because he has depth at other positions. He's set up nicely for a trade there, though. I think he can fix that. I think if he can fix the first base problem, the team is fine. I think he's, you know, clearly, you know, right now set up to make the playoffs in Union. So, you know, and I think kind of by virtue of Hughes having a not so great draft, he's in good shape. And I think he kind of helps serve ultimately.
I have a slightly, you know, more critical view of it, I think. Because there was so much value to be had, I'm bothered by some of the prices. I mean, I think Springer is worth $34 million, but the difference between Beth at 37 and Springer at 34 is kind of ugly, right? And so I think that maybe there, you know, I might rather have, I actually think Springer's gonna have a big year, so it's gonna end up being fine, but it's just a matter of looking at the team as a whole. So spend 34 on Springer and 6.5 on Bailey Ober, who's starting in the minors. He didn't make the Twins, and $5 million on the ghost of Javi Baez.
I think that Baez price is fine, actually. I think there's possibility that Baez could, you know, outperform that contract.
I would hope so. It's just like, he was so bad last year. So I guess it's not to say that he had a bad draft, but I don't think he had like an amazing draft. So I guess that's the same thing as saying hold serve, but I think that there was opportunity for him to pull away more, and he didn't hop on it.
All right. So we did pivot from our plan here, and we ended up just talking about all the teams, but I think that's probably what our listeners wanted to hear anyway. So I'm good with it. We have two left to cover by my count, unless I screwed this up. We got to talk about Josh and we got to talk about Tim. So why don't we start with Tim? Cause Josh is a rebuilder and I think it'll be a little easier to cover that. You guys want to jump in? You want me to start on this one? I can give you guys a behind the scenes thing that, you know, Tim and I, for ever since he put the thing out, it sounds like Byron Buxton's RFAs like transferred 19 times in the offseason, and I almost ended up with him. I really wanted Byron Buxton coming out of this draft. I think 27 is a little high, but I was excited to try to target him, and I think it was me that was bidding him all the way up there because that's who I wanted to get. In fact, he matched on RFAs from my 27 price.
It was, no. Wasn't it? Yeah. But it was silent auction, right?
No. It definitely was not. No, that was one where I was bidding him up. I needed a center fielder. I felt like it was a. I think Buxton's power last year was insane, and I just think it was the breakout. So, because of the injury, I think there's a weird, like, you assumed he was going to be 15 to 20. The dude had 28 home runs last year in a half season. So
yeah, that's,
like,
it's always a half season,
right? I get that. That's why the price is not, you know, 50. But I'm just saying, at the same time, there's a chance that that dude is way undervalued even at 27. So, you know, in the same way that I think going after a DeGrom is a strategy, going after a Buxton is a strategy. And I don't hate it. But I think a lot of what he did seems to be built around that player. Either of you have thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the way Rendon and Buxton go will decide how this team is, right? Because he lacks a second baseman, right? But everywhere else there's solid players, and I really like.
Nope, I disagree.
Oh, where am I missing?
His second utility player is terrible, but Brandon Belt is not a starter in this league for a competitive
team. That's probably
team.
Right. I thought he had somebody else that we could rely on than Belt, but yeah. You two and second. If Rendon is good, though, the offense looks a lot better. I mean, I like the starters too. I like Woodruff and Snell and Manoa. How do you say his name? I mean, I think he's really, I think the thing, this will decide how Tim does this year. If Suzuki comes back and has the breakout that people expect him to have, if Rendon recovers his value, and if Buxton stays healthy, then this team could be good.
But those I'm going to add one more. If McCullers pitches by May 1st.
Okay, nice.
That's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. So you're asking for a lot of things to happen for this team to break well, which to me is, you know, kind of hard, right?
This is kind of a weird criticism, but this really, when I went team by team and started going through the projections, Tim has the worst bench and the worst bullpen, like, by miles. Like, he just has garbage up and down the bench and bullpen. And I'm sorry, Tim, just what the projections say, but like, he has a bunch of $0 players, like negative dollar players in both of those. And there were decent bench and reliever players to be had in it. It's weird. You know, lots of people got lots of good bench and relievers for the men. And I feel like Tim chose poorly to like kind of take some flyers on some guys. And I feel like he doesn't have a lot of depth right now. And he's got some holes on offense and really nothing bullpen. And it's just kind of strange how that played out. So it didn't have to happen.
All right. We got one left to do here. Either of you want to chime in first on Josh?
Sure. I mean, I think that you got to start with how amazing the deal was on Gerrit Cole, right? I mean, I think 49 is amazing because he could have gone for 60 easy. I like the Yelich price at 15. I think Marte, you know, he bought his RFAs, and I think that that's a guy he can flip for at least a pick if he's healthy. And I like the Swanson price at 23, although I would have preferred it to be in the high teens. But, you know, when you're a preseason seller, to have the best pitcher available, I think is really good. I mean, to trade from, I think that you have to go stars and scrubs. And I think that he did a decent job of that with adding in some Cade contracts. My criticism would be LeMahieu at 8 doesn't make any sense for this team. I also think Morton at 20 is a little bit of a poor decision, just given his age and the status of the AIDS this year. I would have rather spent a little bit less on a buzzier guy that if he hits, you have a keeper, and if he or maybe you can trade for some more good prospects.
I just wanted to echo, I have a email, probably I'll have this out tomorrow, on the based on projections what the best buys were in the auction, and Gerrit Cole was the number one best buy in the auction according to ATC. That was huge. And Josh actually has three players in the top 10 on that list. The other one is Yelich, another weirdly Andrew McCutchen.
I was like noticing how long McCutchen stayed out there, and I just feel like we have a bias against him at this point. But
ATC, it's always had him as a $9 million player. And
Josh always gets McCutchen. Have you noticed that? It's like he belongs on Josh's team. We should just like make him on Josh's team permanently. I actually think the Cole contract is going to be super interesting, because now not only is Josh trading the best pitcher if he trades him at midseason, but he's trading an amazing contract on top of it. Right. I'm going to be really curious to see what kind of price he's able to extract, because he's really valuable. He's incredibly valuable if he is able to trade
him. Like it's like he's got, you know, he's going to have 20 million of surplus. Well, I don't know. No one's paying pitchers what they're worth anymore these days. Maybe no one's going to value him that way. But, you know, ATC had him as a $64 million player. So, you know, that's 20 million of value for the next 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a win-win-win for him, right? Because he can hold, and nobody would criticize the keeper situation. But, you know, I think that it was probably the best buy for any. It's a dream buy for a guy who's not trying to compete.
Well, I think we were thrown a curveball by the universe, and it ended up being nice. Like, we covered every team. For our listeners, we were going to try to do the little segment where we, you know, cover matchups and which matchups we thought were going to be particularly important. But it turns out I don't know for certain that we know who's playing who in the first week. So maybe we're saved by the bell on that one a little bit. Because if the schedule is still changing, then we'd be highlighting the wrong stuff potentially. So we can save our listeners of that. I've really enjoyed this tonight, watching the two of you talk about the depth of what you put into this, and just, you know, hearing this. I'm going to just be honest, it's a lot more than what I do. And that's, it's fun for me. Like, I definitely, like, what I do, I listen to podcasts, I try to read a lot, but the mock drafting that you do, Ian, is really fun to hear about. And Star, I know your knowledge about this dwarf's mind. So I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate your putting some thoughts out for our listeners. And curious, before we close, if you have any final thoughts before the season begins here, either one of you. Ian, why don't we start with you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that I try to channel work anxiety into this, and that's why I end up spending so much time on it. And so I'm just thankful to have this community. And I think it was a great off season. I really enjoyed it, and excited for the year. I mean, I'm a little nervous because I feel like this is the year for me. I'm ready to go 20 rounds with Matt, and I really hope to win the double bye. So let's go, big boy.
Let's do it, man. I'm excited. I think it's going to be a weird year. The numbers bear out. It's a bit more of a top heavy season. I feel like there's a top and a bottom and not a lot of middle, which is going to be kind of weird this year. So I'm curious to see if that actually plays out in reality. That's what it looks like on paper right now. I had a great time with everyone this weekend. It's great to see everybody. Hopefully we don't all get COVID. It is what it is.
Yeah. And again, to those who are ill at the moment, I wish you speedy recovery. Ian, I had no idea you had long COVID. I'm happy to hear you're doing better.
I didn't have long COVID. I just got very depressed during it.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Also that sucks. So glad to hear you're doing a little bit better with that too. Guys, enjoy opening day. Enjoy all that, you know, baseball coming back brings. And I'm going to go to a Red Sox game with Veej on Monday, catch our first baseball of the season. The Red Sox are playing the Pirates, so that'll be awful in just about every way. But we'll be at Fenway, and that'll be good. So we'll take a picture and send it out to everybody. And I appreciate it. Anybody?
One final thought is that I'm going to Fenway for the first time in my life this summer.
Oh, yeah. When are you going?
I'm going to go see Dead & Company. I think it's like the third weekend of June. I'm going to catch both the New York shows and then come up for the Fenway show. So I'm excited to be on the field for my first time in Fenway Park.
And it's for a freaking concert. That's amazing, yeah, man.
I know. It's
funny. I saw James Taylor in the exact same circumstance. It's good to shell out for that and like be standing on the infield. It's pretty fun. Yeah. So do you know what day that is? I forget like when that's going to be.
Let's see. It is June 24th, and I might stick around for the 25th as well, depending upon how they're doing. So I'll hit you up when I come to town.
If I'm around, yes, I would love to see you, buddy. I was going to see if there was
Summer's on the Cape. If
Oh, I didn't know that. Cool. I've never been to the Cape. I'd like to go. Oh, but final thought was that you guys got to come out next year for LDB Golf. It was a hoot. We had a great time.
Well, I've been trying to get you guys to come to the Cape. Like I sent the email out. I only got Jorby writing me back. So, you know,
if it's Jorby, not this year, from here,
Jorby smacks the shit out of a golf ball. Yeah. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Jorby and Becker are a lot better than, that's not saying much, but
I look forward to seeing it. I'm looking forward to some LDB Golf. So, all right. And maybe Jorvi will be my ringer, you know, as we get older and I start playing in those tournaments where you get to bring a guest to your club. Like that's the plan.
I think he'd be a good one.
Yeah. Jorvi, you're listening.
He had double bogey and he was so pissed.
Yeah. Well, he plays a lot. It's like anything else. You got to get out there and play if you want to be good. There's no way to do it if you're not practicing. So, all right, boys, this has been really fun. I appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me. And, you know, send me your animus where you are power ranked, folks. I'm happy to chat about it.
Love it. Love it. All right. Until next time, guys.
Bye-bye.
See you guys.